You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
All right, please. This court will be in session. There are Stephen Boyce, presiding judge.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right, Mr. Bailiff, if we're ready, let's please have the jurors brought in.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Please be seated. All right, good morning, everyone. We are going back on the record on case CR 22-21-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. The prosecution's present, as well as the defendant and defense counsel. The court would note the 17 jurors are all present, and each has signed their juror affirmation for today, indicating they did follow the court's admonishing instruction over the weekend. So thank you again for continuing to follow that instruction. When we left off on Friday, we were having direct examination of Agent Heidemann, and I believe we are continuing with that. Is the state ready to proceed with additional direct of the witness?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. The witness can return to the stand. No. All right. Continuing then with direct examination of Tactical Specialist Heidemann, I'll remind the witness you are still under oath for your testimony. I'll just briefly inquire, with the court's exclusionary ruling, did you watch any other testimony over the weekend of anyone else that's testified in trial? Okay. Thank you for following that instruction, Ms. Blake. If you'd like to continue on direct, you may.
Thank you. And Ms. Heidemann, just for the benefit of the jury, we were talking about the James and Elena story. Do you recall that? And who was James an alias for? And who was Elena an alias for? As part of your investigation, we talked about that you pulled portions of what appeared to be part of that story and pieced it back together. Is that correct? Did you also find some additional text messages that you documented somewhere else? And with those text messages, did you pull them over as written? And did that include pulling over the date stamp and the corresponding information? And Your Honor, I do not have this marked as an exhibit. I've showed it to defense counsel previously. I was going to show Ms. Heidemann portions of what I would purport to be part of her report to allow her to look at them.
Okay.
And if we want counsel to look first, that's fine as well.
Yeah, let's have the defense review that. And this would be to refresh the witness's recollection. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in part, if I may have the witness shown those. Ms. Heidemann, do you recognize those two pages?
Yes, I do.
Do those, in fact, appear to be a portion of a report written by you?
Yes, they are.
And Your Honor, these portions, well, actually, I will clarify. Were these pulled from either the Lolly Time or the Lori for Style at iCloud?
I believe these are from the Lolly Time.
And Your Honor, we have previously stipulated to admit the contents of the Lolly Time iCloud account. And based on that, my intent was to simply have Ms. Heidemann read a few excerpts from these messages.
Any objection to proceeding in that manner, Mr. Pryor?
No objection, Judge.
Okay. The witness may do so.
And Ms. Heidemann, looking at the first page there, that bottom text, can you indicate the date and time on that text?
August 9th, 2019 at 9:29:47 p.m. UTC minus 6.
And who was the message sent from?
It's actually from a 515 number attributed to Chad.
And who was it going to?
Lori.
And can you read just the last two sentences, starting with "he kissed"?
He kissed her deeply as their breathing slowed. They entwined their bodies and held each other tightly before soon beginning another powerful round of pleasurable bonding.
And then if you turn to that next page, you indicate the date and time that first message was sent?
And it's on August 9th, 2019 at 9:36:03 p.m. in UTC minus 6 time.
And can you tell who it is being sent from and who it is being sent to?
This one is from Lori to Chad.
And could you read it into the record, including the emojis, please?
That is pretty incredible. Fire emoji, fire emoji, fire emoji, fire emoji, fire emoji. The fire is definitely burning. The memories. Heart, heart, heart. I miss you way too much. You have to stop or I might explode.
And then can you indicate the date and time on the next message?
August 9th, 2019 at 9:38:27 p.m. UTC minus six.
And who did the message appear to be sent from and to whom was it going?
Again, from Lori to Chad.
And could you read the content into the record?
The intensity of each encounter in my mind, one greater than the last. Oh my, fire emoji, especially this last one. I've never loved you more, heart. It just keeps growing, kiss emoji.
And then that next one, if you could indicate the date and time.
August 9th, 2019 at 9:39:54 p.m. in UTC minus six time.
And who did it appear to be being sent from and to whom was it going?
From Chad to Lori.
And could you please read it into the record?
I completely agree. We were definitely in new territory in your bedroom.
And then the following message?
On August 10th, 2019 at 4:38:08 p.m. in UTC minus six time.
And who did it appear to be going from and who was it being sent to?
From Chad to Lori.
Can you read it into the record?
Elena's magic hand has gripped the storm, and they stare into each other's eyes, barely able to breathe as intense waves wash over them.
And through the investigation, did you learn what storm was a name for?
It appeared to be a name for Chad's penis.
And then the next message there, can you indicate the date and time?
August 10th, 2019, 4:38:45 p.m. in UTC minus six time.
And who was it being sent from and to whom?
From Lori to Chad.
And could you read it into the record?
Yes, she did.
And did those appear to be a continual text thread?
They did. They were chronological. It looks like there was probably a half a day or so difference.
And then if you skip down to line 1033.
Okay.
If you could read the date and time into the record.
33. August 10th, 2019, 4:54:31 p.m. in UTC minus six time.
And who did it appear to be being sent from and to whom was it being sent to?
From Chad to Lori.
And could you read it into the record?
I love you, Elena. What a wonderful chemistry we share.
And then if you could read the next one, if you could indicate the date and time into the record.
August 10th, 2019, 4:55:17 p.m. in UTC minus six time.
And if you could indicate who it was believed the message was being sent from and to whom it was being sent.
From Lori to Chad.
And could you read the content into the record?
I love you more. That's so hot. I just need you more than ever. Heart, heart.
And then the last line there, if you could indicate the date and time into the record.
August 10th, 2019 at 4:58:02 p.m. in UTC minus six time.
And who did it appear to be going from and to whom was it being sent?
From Chad to Lori.
And could you read the content into the record?
You are amazing. Please save that segment. I want to read it with you naked, then relive it all.
And did those appear to be a text thread?
Yes.
And again, as part of your role in this, were you reading through the James and Elena to determine if it corresponded to real life events?
I did.
And did you in fact determine that there appeared to be some events in James and Elena that corresponded with what was going on with Chad and Lori?
Yes.
And again, in the James and Elena, when Chad and Lori would meet up, were there oftentimes descriptions of physical encounters as well?
Yes.
May I have just a moment? I have no further questions, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Boyd.
And I would just indicate Ms. Heidemann still has those few pages. I don't know if counsel wants her to keep those.
I'll have the bailiff retrieve those, please, and return those to you. Those weren't exhibits, so I'll have them returned to you, Ms. Blake.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Pryor, cross-examination once you're ready.
Start out early. How can I address you? May I also call you Ms. Heidemann?
Yeah.
Thank you. Ms. Heidemann, as part of the exhibit that the state described as the James and Elena story, were you able to determine whether there were chapter breaks in this this story?
In the emails that were sent, it appeared there were chapter one, chapter two. I forgot how many chapters exactly there were, but in some of them, yes, and others, no.
Okay, so like if I'm referring to page nine, it says end of chapter one, and then it starts as chapter two.
Right.
So can we presume that this was a another book that Chad was writing?
I don't know if he intended to publish it.
Okay.
Doesn't
But obviously referring to something as chapter one and then going, breaking it up and describing chapter two as the start of the next series, that would seem to suggest that at least there was an intent to put this in book form, correct?
Objection, Your Honor. Calls for speculation.
Sustained.
Okay. Is there any indication, any of the emails, that the intent of this was to write a book?
Not that I could tell, no.
Now, as far as the search for the word malachite, you mentioned that Chad looked at that in March of 2018, correct?
Correct.
He didn't know Lori Vallow at that point, correct?
Correct.
And then it was Lori Vallow who initially did the searching for the malachite, correct?
I would have to look back at the report to figure out which days.
And then as far as the correspondence is concerned, Chad Daybell's, one of those was his response to the Lori Vallow searching for malachite.
I'm sorry, what was the question? Is
Lori Vallow searched at least did most of the Google searching for the malachite. Would you agree with that?
I don't know about counts.
Okay.
Who did the most searches? I don't know. I'd have to look at my report again.
You talked about the temple records and you provided a long list of temple records. There was a frequent visit by Chad Daybell to the temple, even when he wasn't visiting with Lori Vallow. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
He was a regular attender of the temple.
That's correct.
Okay. Regardless of his infidelity or the affair that was going on, he was still attending the temple, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Did you come across any information that on one of the visits to the temple, when Lori and Chad were there, that other people had had attended at the same time as Lori and Chad?
It's possible that other people were there, yes.
People who they knew as part of a group. Did you see anything that suggested that?
I only had the records for Chad and Lori's cards.
You didn't happen to look at Melanie Gibb or anybody else at the same time who possibly could have been there?
I did not have their records, no.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pryor.
Ms. Heideman, through your review of records, were both Chad and Lori looking for malachite?
They were.
Were those searches occurring when their spouses were still alive?
Yes.
Did Lori and Chad, in fact, end up married in Hawaii?
They did.
What type of rings did they exchange?
Malachite rings.
Were Melanie Gibb's kids missing?
No.
I have no further questions.
All right. That will conclude the testimony then of this witness. Witness has been returned after previously testifying. Does the state have any intention of calling the witness at any other time going forward?
No, Your Honor. She may be released.
All right. From the defense, can she also be released? Is there a subpoena, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, that'll conclude your testimony. Thank you for appearing and testifying. You may go ahead and step down, and you're no longer subject to the court's exclusionary order. All right. The state can call its next witness.
Judge, at this time, the state would call Dr. Angie Christensen.
All right.
Solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God. Yeah.
Next, be clear.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Mr. Wixom, Mr. Pryor, could I have a very brief sidebar, please? All right, thanks. The court had an inquiry regarding whether or not the exclusionary order would apply to this witness based on her potentially proffering expert testimony. I think at this point it would apply. However, going forward, it may not. So with that in mind, since the witness has been sworn at this time, Dr. Christensen, I will just inquire, have you been watching or viewed any of the testimony that's taken place in this trial since it started?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Have you talked to anyone else about testimony they've provided?
No.
Okay. Well, then, Mr. Wixom, if you'd like to proceed on direct, you can do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ma'am, will you please state your full name for the record?
My name is Angie Christensen, and Angie is spelled A-N-G-I. Christensen is spelled C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-S-E-N.
And ma'am, your title is a doctor, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. And can you explain to the jury, what are you a doctor of?
I have a PhD in the area of anthropology.
Okay. And where do you work?
I work at the FBI laboratory in Quantico, Virginia.
How long have you worked there?
Since September of 2004, so almost 20 years.
What is your job title and function at Quantico?
I am a forensic anthropologist.
Could you briefly explain to the jury what work does a forensic anthropologist do?
Yes. Forensic anthropology is actually a pretty broad field involving the examination analysis of human skeletal remains or potential human skeletal remains.
And what about your education? Could you tell the jury what your educational background is, please?
Yes, I have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a PhD, all in the area of anthropology.
Where did you receive those degrees?
My bachelor's degree I received from the University of Washington in Seattle, and my master's and PhD were both received from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville.
Prior to the FBI, had you done any work in forensic anthropology?
As a graduate student, I assisted with some forensic anthropology casework, but the FBI laboratory was my primary employment following my PhD.
Do you have any certifications or specializations within your field?
Yes, I'm board certified by the American Board of Forensic Anthropology, as well as the Forensic Anthropology Society of Europe.
And do you likewise, have you published articles in your field?
Yes, I've published a number of peer-reviewed research articles, as well as books and book chapters in the area of forensic anthropology.
And are you acquainted with Dr. Bartolink?
Yes.
How are you acquainted with him?
The field of forensic anthropology is relatively small. There are maybe 100 to 150 board-certified practitioners, so my work overlaps with Dr. Bartolink frequently. We're also co-authors on one of the books that I previously mentioned.
Do you consider him a colleague?
Yes.
And can you explain to the jury what role, if any, does a forensic anthropologist play in terms of supporting or helping an ME or a pathologist?
So forensic anthropology is a complementary but different examination than forensic pathology. Forensic anthropologists specialize in the analysis of skeletal remains. So often a forensic anthropology examination and report will be a supplement to an autopsy report performed by a pathologist.
And when you do work as a forensic anthropologist and you review skeletal remains, can you briefly explain to the jury what kind of a process does that involve for you?
It depends on the nature of the skeletal remains and what types of questions are being asked. But generally speaking, the skeleton can be analyzed visually, microscopically, using x-rays, by taking measurements. And this is typically done to either aid in the process of identifying to whom the skeletal remains might belong or looking for any evidence of trauma that may have affected the skeleton.
Before we go to the focus of this case, I'd like to invite you to explain to the jury some terms that you use in your field. Can we start with thermally altered? What does that mean?
Thermally altered means that the bones have been damaged by some sort of heat or fire.
And what types of things do you look for to determine or identify thermal alteration?
Thermal alteration is evidenced on bones by the bone being discolored. So bone is naturally sort of a creamy white or yellow color. And when heat is applied, it will turn black and brown and eventually white. Burning also causes bones to become very fragile, so they often fragment or fracture very easily.
And with that, can you explain to the jury the term biomechanically fresh state?
Biomechanically fresh refers to a condition of bones that's similar to or in life, where you think of bones as being a very brittle material, but in fact, in life, they're somewhat flexible. Bones have a little bit of bend. So a biomechanically fresh bone still has that bending sort of quality. A bone that is much older, that's become very brittle, will fracture in a different way. Imagine, for example, a fresh twig versus a dry branch. So that fresh twig, if you try to bend it and break it, it's got a little bit of bend and give and doesn't break the same way as that dry stick if you try to bend it and break it. So bone that's biomechanically fresh still has some of that bendable quality.
And what about the term sharp trauma? How does that apply to your work?
Sharp trauma refers to a force applied to a bone from an external source by something that is with a very small surface area, typically a sharp or beveled edge.
And perhaps you've already included this, but if not, could you explain more? If you identify a bone that's been hinged or bent, what does that mean?
A hinged or bent bone means that the trauma occurred when that bone was still in that biomechanically fresh state, so had that bending quality.
What does that How does that factor into an analysis? For example, if you identify a bone that you believe to have been hinged or bent, what does that tell you as an anthropologist?
It tells me that the trauma was imparted when that bone was still in that fresh state, so may have been at or around the time of death. But bone can still retain those biomechanically fresh properties into the postmortem period. So I can't say for certain when that trauma happened with respect to the death event, but when the bone was still in a biomechanically fresh state.
And perhaps you've done this, but can you explain to the jury the term perimortem? What does that mean?
Perimortem means at or around the time of death. But as I mentioned, this is used a bit differently in anthropological contexts compared to the way a pathologist or medical examiner might use it, because I'm only looking at the skeletal tissues, not any of the surrounding soft tissues. So determining when trauma occurred to a bone, I can only look at how the bone reacted to that force. So perimortem refers to it occurring in that biomechanically fresh state, but that could have happened shortly before the death event, at the time of the death event, or sometime after.
And the term postmortem, can you distinguish perimortem from postmortem and the factors you look at to make the distinction?
Yes. So postmortem refers to occurring after the death event. And anthropologically speaking, postmortem trauma would be evidenced by bone having that more brittle quality, like that dry stick. It's going to fracture differently because the bone has become dried.
And in your work at the FBI, do you recall receiving a referral from the Ada County, Idaho coroner's office?
Yes.
And did that referral include remains from Tylee Ryan?
Yes.
And it did, in fact, you do an analysis of Tylee's remains?
Yes, I did.
Before we go into the details, can you just explain to the jury what types of things did you do to perform your analysis on her remains overall?
Overall, I examined these remains visually, microscopically, by taking measurements, and by using x-rays.
Your Honor, at this time, I have what has been previously marked as State's Exhibit 181, as well as State's Exhibit 182. A copy has been provided to the defense, and I have two for the court, one as a courtesy, one as the actual proposed exhibit I'd like to offer up. They are stipulated to be admitted, Your Honor.
Okay.
And perhaps I'll clarify, Judge, 181A through I are documented photographs of Tylee's remains, and 182 are just a couple of demonstrative exhibits of a human skeleton, for the record.
All right. Not to interrupt things again, Mr. Wixon, but I want a quick sidebar, if I could, and look at these.
Certainly. To indicate with your pointer to the jury which bone specifically we're looking at.
Yes, so it's the left innominate or hip bone, which is this bone right here.
Actually, ma'am, did you make any type of determination as to what kind of force that may have created these different sharp alterations?
At this point, there hasn't been sufficient foundation to support that kind of conclusion.
Sustained.
Ma'am, when you identify sharp trauma in bones, what different types of trauma can occur?
Trauma to bones is typically categorized as one of several general categories of force. Typically either blunt force, which is a force imparted by an object moving at a relatively slow speed with a relatively large surface area. High velocity projectile trauma is a result of force that occurred over a relatively small surface area from something moving at a high rate of speed. Sharp trauma refers to trauma that was imparted to bones by something with a pointed or beveled edge. And thermal, sometimes called trauma, usually called alteration, which we've discussed, results in fracturing and discoloration of the bone.
In your analysis of Tylee's remains, were you able to identify what you believe to be either blunt or sharp trauma?
I identified numerous sharp traumas.
Are either of those depicted in this photograph here?
Yes, five of them are depicted in this photograph.
Could you identify with each one through five what you believe to be either blunt or sharp trauma?
All of them indicated here are sharp trauma.
Okay, thank you. For the record, ma'am, I've placed States 181D on the screen. Can you explain to the jury what did you document in that photo?
These are not photos, but these are images of a CT scan of the same bone that was shown in the previous photographs. And a CT scan is simply a bunch of x-rays that are stacked together to make a three-dimensional image. So in this case, what I was looking at during my examination was a three-dimensional file that I can rotate and manipulate. And what you're seeing here are two-dimensional screen captures of that 3D file.
Okay. And can you indicate exactly what it was you were documenting in the photo? CT scan, sorry.
Yes. In this CT scan, again, I'm documenting the condition of the remains during my examination, including the assessment of the sharp traumas.
And could you explain some of the marks that we see with your laser pointer?
I don't have them annotated here as I did with on the numbering as in the photographs, but some of those sharp traumas can be seen, for example, here. Here, one here, and here.
And is this the left or the right side of the bone, the pelvic bone?
This is the left side.
Thank you. Anything else that you believe this documents?
No.
The record I'm going to place on the screen states 181E. Do you explain to the jury what that photograph documents?
These photographs document detail or close-up views of the same sharp traumas depicted in the previous two images. So in this case, I do have them annotated so that they can be correlated to the overall picture of the bone. It also documents in these close-up views some of that bending or hinging of the bone that tells me it occurred when the bone was in that biomechanically fresh state.
So when you indicate that these photos illustrate that the bone was in a biomechanically fresh state. Is it correct that you still can't be certain whether it was postmortem versus paramortem? Is that correct?
Yes. So we classify that as perimortem trauma being in a biomechanically fresh state, but I can't say for certain that didn't occur sometime after the death event when the body was still biomechanically fresh.
So it is consistent with both perimortem and postmortem. Is that correct?
Yes.
Please. As you consider the different trauma versus thermal images and other things that you found in your analysis, particularly to this sharp trauma, is this anything that could have occurred naturally or from disease inside the body?
No. Sharp traumas are something that is caused by an external force that's imported on the remains, and disease processes have a much different appearance where the bone is responding to that disease.
And in your experience and background, do you have experience identifying potential trauma that is a result of dismemberment?
Judge,
yes.
I'm going to object at this point. It's becoming leading.
Overruled.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question for me?
In your background, do you have experience in identifying injury to a bone that could occur from dismemberment?
Yes.
Okay. What do you look for to determine signs of dismemberment?
Typically, dismemberment will occur in that what we call perimortem, but typically shortly into the postmortem period, and usually occurs around the joints. Because typically the purpose of dismemberment is to break the body into smaller portions or remove portions that might be easily identifiable.
So in fairness, in your evaluation of Tylee's bones, did you determine any of these alterations to be consistent with dismemberment?
No.
And why not?
Because they all occur around the pelvic region, which isn't a region that you would typically see sharp traumas if somebody were trying to dismember the body.
And in these particular areas where there is sharp trauma, did you find any indication of thermal damage?
Not in the direct area. So there are some portions of the hip bones that have some thermal alteration, but all of the areas with the sharp traumas are unburned.
Do you recall, as you sit there, approximately how many bones of Tylee's were included in the remains that were sent to you to evaluate?
I don't remember exactly. I think in this case, more than 100 bones were submitted, but some of these bones were so broken and thermally damaged that I wasn't able to conclude that they were definitively human in origin. I'm not sure of the exact number that could be identified to Tylee.
Can you explain to the jury why is it that some bones would have been more thermally damaged than others?
When a body is burned, there tends to be a pattern that's typical of which areas are damaged first. And basically, it's just areas that have less soft tissue and other covering protecting the remains tend to be burned first. So, for example, the top of the head, the fronts of the knees, the elbows, these areas have very little soft tissue protection. So if exposed to fire, they will burn first. Areas of the body that tend to burn last are those that are better protected by other muscle and tissues, for example, the thorax, including the pelvic region.
And ma'am, on this particular exhibit, if you'll note for the top, do you see the notation of item 16?
Yes.
Okay. What is that referencing?
That references the fact that when evidence is received by my laboratory, every item of evidence is given an item number. In this case, that bone happens to be designated item 16.
And in item 16, if I'm correct, that is primarily documentation of sharp trauma, correct?
Yes.
So this, I think you've indicated there's some thermal damage in this bone.
Yes, I believe there was some thermal alteration to the top part of the hip bone.
Thank you. I've now placed on the screen what's been marked as State's Exhibit 182F. Can you explain to the jury, what is this a photo of?
These are photos documenting the right hip bone or innominate, which is designated item 19.
And I notice approximately six notations in this photo?
Yes, these I've designated the sharp traumas that I identified as 1 through 6.
First of all, can you indicate for the jury, on the bottom there, do you see a notation of item 19?
Yes.
And what does that number represent?
Again, that's just a number that was designated to represent this item of evidence at my laboratory.
And so that's an FBI indicated number, is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. Would you just briefly, with your pointer, go through numbers 1 through 6 and just explain to the jury what you're documenting here, please?
Again, my photographs are documenting the condition of the remains as I receive them, as well as, in this case, a number of the sharp alterations. You see here depicted numbers 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6. I believe number 2 is shown in another photograph, but just isn't visible from this view.
Maybe just what do we see in item number 1?
In item 19, trauma number 1.
Yeah, as you've got noted, are those annotations that you made on the photograph, 1 through 6?
So I took these photographs and then I annotated it with these labeled numbers just to be able to clarify where the traumas were and to keep them consistent across photographs.
And what kind of trauma is number 1?
Number 1 is sharp trauma. It's a bit difficult to see with the glare, but it's there at the end of the arrow.
And you indicated that number 2 is not seen in these photos. Is that right?
That's correct.
What is number 3? What type of trauma?
Numbers 3, 4, 5, and 6 are all sharp traumas.
Does this photo also depict any thermal damage?
Yes, I think it's a bit difficult to see in this picture, but the innominates had some discoloration consistent with exposure to fire or heat on the top of the hip bone.
And I don't recall if you said or if I asked, but which particular bone is this in the body?
This is the right innominate or hip bone.
And again, going to 182A, will you just point that out for the jury, please?
Yes. So that's this bone right here, the right side of the hip.
And is that the front side of the hip or the back side?
This picture is depicting the front of the body.
Let me ask a better question. Is your photo a depiction of the front or the back?
Neither. This one is basically from the inside or the medial side, and this one from the lateral or the outside.
Okay, thanks. For the record, I've now put up 181G. Can you please tell the jury what you were trying to document in that photo?
In this exhibit, the top photo is, one of the sharp traumas depicted in the previous pictures, sharp trauma number 6. And this one also documents that hinging or bending of the bone that lets me know that the bone was at a biomechanically fresh state. The images on the bottom are not photographs, but again, these are those two-dimensional captures of the three-dimensional CT scan that I created.
And help us understand, what is it that you're capturing with CT scan that you don't from the photo? Why do you do that CT scan?
It doesn't always provide additional information from the photo. Sometimes it allows me to see internal structures that aren't visible with the unaided eye. In this case, it helps me to make a three-dimensional model that I can refer to at a later time, that I can incorporate into my notes, and that I can use to document the condition of the remains in addition to supplement to photographs.
Okay. And if I could see correctly, in the CT scan, there are approximately five numeric notations.
They denote six of the sharp traumas, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
For the record, I'm placing up. Actually, let me go back. I'm sorry. On 181G that we just had up, I just put back up there. What is the internal FBI item number on the bottom?
That is item number 19.
Okay. Now I'm placing 181H on the screen. And let's start with, what's the FBI item number on this exhibit?
This was designated item 17.
What is item 17?
Item 17 consists of the sacrum, or it's the bottom of the spine between the two hip bones in the back, as well as four of the lumbar vertebrae. And these remain attached by some of the remaining soft tissue and ligaments.
And back overall, when you receive these remains into the FBI, can you briefly explain the process when Quantico intakes a reference item from an outside agency? What's the process?
Yes. So when evidence is received by the FBI laboratory, it's first delivered to our evidence management unit. And in that unit, they inspect the packaging and the evidence to look for any damage. They cross-examine look at the evidence compared to the accompanying letter requesting the examination to make sure that the evidence that they intended to submit was received by the FBI laboratory. The evidence management unit then creates what's called an examination plan. So they determine which units in the laboratory, which disciplines might examine that evidence, and in what order. So for example, does it need a DNA examination, fingerprint examination, or anthropology? And they then have the evidence routed to that evidence for examination.
And when remains are received, is it common for tissue to still be remaining on bones?
I wouldn't say common, but it happens sometimes in anthropology cases, yes.
So when in those instances where there is tissue, what's the process to either remove it or leave it on? Can you kind of explain that some more, please?
It depends on the nature of the examination and how much tissue is remaining. In this case, I didn't remove that remaining soft tissue because I felt I could see all of the portions of the bone that I wanted to see from my examination. If there's a lot of adhering tissue or soil or other debris that's obstructing my view of the bone surface, I might remove that material as part of my examination. And depending on what that material is and how difficult it is to remove, that might involve just taking a nylon brush to the bones. Sometimes it involves soaking the bones in water to loosen that attached material and then removing it later.
So do you recall in either the bones in this exhibit versus the ones we've already gone through, did you have to do anything to remove tissue from the remains?
I did remove tissue from some of the remains in this case. I believe portions of an ankle and foot had a lot of remaining soft tissue, and those I did remove, but I did not remove any tissue from the items that we have looked at so far.
Perhaps it's obvious, but if in fact the ankle and foot did have more tissue, what, if anything, does that tell you about the burn pattern on the remains? Anything?
I don't recall whether I saw any burning on those parts at this time.
So back to this particular exhibit, in item 17, what does this document?
This is documenting on the top there. You can see this is the condition of the remains as I receive them. And the lower pictures are close-up or detailed views of a sharp trauma that I identified, which I marked number one.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I missed that. Which trauma did you identify as number one?
There was only one on the sacrum, which is here.
And what was the nature of that trauma?
This is a sharp trauma.
Okay. Is there anything else that this photo documents?
No.
Okay. Placing on the screen states 181I. Can we start by indicating on the bottom, what item number is that?
This is item number 17. So the same item that was depicted in the previous slide.
Okay. And what is this, an X-ray, a CT scan?
This is an X-ray, so not the three-dimensional CT scan with X-rays stacked together, just three X-rays from different views.
Why, in this instance, did you use an X-ray instead of a CT scan as opposed to with some of the other exhibits?
In this case, I'd only identified visually the one sharp trauma. So in this case, I was just using the X-rays to see if there were any foreign materials or other traumas that I hadn't seen with the naked eye.
Did you identify anything like that?
I found nothing in addition to the one sharp trauma that I had already identified visually.
So is there anything else that this documents at all?
No.
Now, when you received remains, and particularly in Tylee's case, did you prepare a report?
Yes.
And was that report inclusive of your findings of everything that you analyzed?
Yes.
And is that a report that you would then, excuse me, normally, and in fact, in this case, did you refer that back to the referencing medical examiner from Idaho?
Yes.
Okay. Now, may I have just a moment, please, Judge?
You may.
Your Honor, at this time, likewise, I have state's proposed exhibit 422. It is also admitted by stipulation, which for the record is the FBI lab report that I'd like to offer for admission. I've got courtesy for the court, the proposed exhibit, and then a copy for the defense.
The court's considered this, Mr. Pryor. Is there any objection to the admission of 422?
Judge, it's by stipulation of the parties.
422 is admitted.
May I ask to have that handed to the witness if she doesn't have it?
You just handed it to me. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am, what is that?
This is a copy of the laboratory report that I issued in this case.
And does that report include the summary of your findings that you've just testified about?
Yes.
And is that the report that you forwarded to the Idaho ME?
To Ada County Coroner's Office, yes.
And just the last couple of questions, in your analysis and preparation for your testimony today, did you also receive a report from a Dr. Bartolink?
Yes, I did.
The same doctor we referenced at the beginning?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you review that report?
I did.
Okay. In that report, did you find anything that was said?
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. There hasn't been sufficient foundation.
Response, Mr. Wixom.
Judge, I simply asked her if she'd been provided that report. And she said she's reviewed it. I suppose we could get the report and get the date, but.
All right. The objection's overruled. Go ahead.
So you did, in fact, review that report?
Yes.
Okay. Did you find anything in Dr. Bartolink's findings that was substantially different than your own findings?
No. And in fact, Dr. Bartolink stated in his report that there were no substantive differences between our analyses.
Did anything about what you saw in that report have any influence or change in the way you testified today affect your observations?
No.
Your Honor, at this time, I have no further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wixom. All right. Mr. Pryor, cross-examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
You mentioned that you published an article or a book with Dr. Bartolink.
Yes.
And counsel brought this up. Obviously, Dr. Bartolink is the defense expert in this case. Is that right?
To my knowledge, yes, that's what I've been advised.
You did read his report, right?
Yes, I did.
And his findings?
Yes.
And you find that your findings are consistent with Dr. Bartolink's?
Yes. Our examination requests were somewhat different and our report formatting significantly different. But in terms of the substantive content of our analyses of Tylee's remains, there were no substantive differences.
Now, one of the areas I'd like to delve into a little bit is the... is there a specialty within each of your occupations as a forensic anthropologist? Do you have a particular focus that differs from Dr. Bartolink's?
Not especially. Most anthropologists, especially those who are board certified, have a core set of knowledge and expertise. A lot of my research has been in the area of skeletal trauma and skeletal imaging.
And are you aware of whether a lot of what Dr. Bartolink's focus has been on throughout his career?
Not specifically, no. I'm familiar with some of his work, but I do not have access to his reports or findings.
Okay. And you mentioned that...
I apologize to interrupt, but could I get a spelling on Dr. Bartolink's name, please, if you do have it?
I do, Judge. Bartelink.
Thank you.
Eric Bartolink.
Okay.
And to your knowledge, Dr. Bartolink has all of the accreditation and all the certifications consistent with what you have as well. Is that right?
I am aware that he is also certified by the American Board of Forensic Anthropology. Yes.
And
Absolutely. I'm aware that Dr. Bartolink is certified by the American Board of Forensic Anthropology.
This is not a large group of folks that focus in this particular area, is there?
It's a relatively specialized area, yes.
Would it be fair to say that you know most of the folks within your specialty and have either interacted with them or consulted with them or worked with them?
Yes, many or most, yes.
And again, Dr. Bartolink is one of those which is qualified within your specialty. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the postmortem carnivore marks.
Yes.
Can you tell me where those marks, when those marks were put on the body?
Typically, carnivore scavenging is a postmortem activity.
Okay. And when you say carnivore, we're not limited to wild or domestic, are we? We don't know what kind of animal may have done this, correct?
No. Carnivore refers to a meat-eating mammal, and there are a wide variety of them that would scavenge human remains.
And we don't know exactly where the remains were at the time these carnivore marks were placed upon the skeletal remains. Is that right?
No, I do not.
Yeah. Can you describe to me, just in general, the if any parts of the skeletal that were not discovered as part of this examination?
Well, in terms of the discovery, I can't say. I can only speak to what evidence was submitted to me at my laboratory. But there were a number of parts of the skeleton that were missing or absent. Most of those, consistent with the burn pattern that we talked about earlier, where portions of the body are more susceptible to burning and fracture.
But you can't say that those skeletal remains are missing as a result of the burning. They could be missing for a variety of reasons, correct?
I don't know why they're missing. That's correct.
Okay. What you do know is that at least portions of the bones had burn marks on them, correct?
That's correct.
And again, there were also portions of the body where there were no burn marks. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And when you talk about the trauma that was inflicted on the body, you don't know when that was done, correct?
I can tell that it occurred when the bone was in a biomechanically fresh state, but precisely when that happened relative to the death event, no, I cannot.
Okay. Judge, I have nothing else. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pryor. Any redirect, Mr. Wixom?
Very briefly, Judge.
Very well.
Ma'am, in your testimony with me a few moments ago, you referenced that there was a number of remains and bone fragments that have been sent to you. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Were there among those many bones some that had been severely damaged thermally?
Yes, there were a number of bones and bone fragments that were so thermally damaged or thermally altered that I was not able to tell whether they were human or not in origin or which part of the human body they might have come from.
And in fact, were there bones that you could tell were human in origin that had been more severely thermally damaged than what we've shown the jury?
Yes, there were other parts of the skeleton that were identifiable as human that weren't pictured here today.
Do you recall, as you sit there, what were some of those other bones?
I don't recall. If I might be able to review my case notes, I could tell you, but there were parts of the body that were more thermally altered. More thermally altered.
Thank you. Your Honor, I have no more questions.
All right. That'll conclude the examination then of this witness. Is she going to remain under subpoena from either side?
Judge, at this point, I think we would want to keep her on subpoena. She's not a likely recall, but we would have her stay on subpoena.
Okay. And so you will remain under subpoena in terms of whether or not the exclusionary rule would apply for any expert testimony. I'll leave that up to the state to advise the witness, and we'll review that matter if she is recalled to the stand. You may go ahead and step down. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask, is the state requesting to start with another witness at this point, or perhaps take the mid-morning recess a bit earlier than usual now that there's a break right now?
And Your Honor, our next witness is probably going to be pretty quick. I'll defer to the court on whether or not the court would like us to get that done or take the break now.
Any requests from the jurors now or later? Doesn't matter. Now?
No.
I didn't get a good read, but I don't know. You say it'll be a quick witness. Okay, thank you. Let's call the next witness. Thank you.
State would call Ashlyn Rind.
Your Honor,
I'm being told that this witness stepped out to use the restroom. And I apologize.
Well, let's go ahead and take the mid-morning recess with that then. Thank you, everyone.
All right, please. All right, please. We'll be back with
that. All right, thank you. Mr. Bailiff, we could have the jurors brought in once they're ready.
Jury is present now.
All right, thank you. Please be seated. All right, the state can call its next witness. We're back on the record. I'll mention CR 2221-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell, just concluded our mid-morning recess. And if the state has another witness, we can call them.
State would call Ashlyn Rind, Your Honor.
Very well.
Swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Okay.
All right. I'll note the witness has been sworn. Before we proceed with testimony, let me just inquire, Ms. Rind, have you watched any of the trial testimony on the broadcast of this trial or seen anything in person here since this trial started?
No, sir.
All right. Have you talked to anyone else about testimony they've given during trial?
No, sir.
Okay. Thanks for answering those questions. Ms. Beatty, if you'd like to inquire, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you state your full name and then spell your last name?
Yeah. My name is Ashlyn Renee Rind, R-Y-N-D.
Where do you live?
Chandler, Arizona.
How long have you lived in Chandler?
22 years now.
Did you know an individual by the name of Tylee Ryan?
I did, yes.
How did you know Tylee?
We were best friends in high school.
Do you remember approximately what year you met Tylee?
I want to say 2016 is when I met her.
And what high school did you attend with Tylee?
Prairie High School. Perry High School.
And that's in Chandler?
Yes, ma'am.
What kinds of things would you and Tylee do together?
We would go on drives together, talk about just teenage things, you know, our high school boy drama, drama with friends, what was going on in her life, what was going on in mine. We would just spend a lot of time together, just hanging out like at home and stuff.
Did you feel like you knew Tylee pretty well?
Very well, yeah.
Did you ever go to Tylee's house in Chandler?
Yes.
About how often would you visit Tylee at her house?
Frequently. I would even say once a week, maybe twice a week even.
And in visiting Tylee at her house, did you ever meet any of her family members?
I did, yes. I met Charles. I met Lori, JJ. I met Alex before too.
And could you just briefly describe kind of what you observed about Tylee's relationship with JJ?
Almost maternal in the sense that she was always there to make sure he was cared for. First priority was making sure his well-being was always taken care of and she would be next.
And tell us who Alex was.
Alex was her uncle, and he was also, I want to say, Lori's brother, but just another family member who was around for Tylee and would be there in case like Lori or Charles wasn't there.
About how often did you interact with or see Alex Cox?
Not as often. I would say maybe 6 months of the year I would see him. Not saying like I'd see him 6 months. Once every 6 months might see him.
Okay. Did you make any observations about the nature of his relationship with Tylee?
Friendly. It seemed very much the normal teenage to uncle relationship. They joked around a lot, had a good relationship there. And I know he offered her a place to stay when she needed it.
Did she feel comfortable with Alex from what you could observe?
She did, yeah.
Okay. At some point, did Tylee move away from Chandler?
She did. She moved to Idaho in 2019. I remember moving to Texas before that too.
And let's start with when she moved to Texas. Do you remember approximately when that was?
In 2017 or 2018, during my junior year of high school.
And just to be clear for the jury, when she moved to Texas, did she come back to Chandler at some point?
She did, yes. She came back for a short period of time. And then I want to say maybe 6 months later, it was, we're going to go to Idaho.
So while she was in Texas, did you stay in contact with her?
Yes. Yeah.
And when she returned to Chandler, did you continue to spend time with her?
Yeah. The second she got home.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember approximately when Tylee moved to Idaho?
That must have been, I want to say sometime in September of 2019, end of the summer.
Did you stay in contact with Tylee after she moved to Idaho?
Tried to for the 2 weeks that I had. And then after that, it kind of fell off. So I wasn't able to.
Okay.
Your Honor, if I could have just one moment.
Yes.
And I have no further questions for this witness.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Pryor, you can cross.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Ms. Rind.
Good morning.
Ms. Rind, you mentioned that Alex was around. You maybe saw him every 6 months or so?
Every so often. I say that roughly as an estimate. He was a truck driver, so with his work and with my schooling, I wasn't able to always see him.
So the opportunity to observe him is when he was in town occasionally, and you saw, would you say it was a handful of times that you saw Alex interact with Tylee?
Essentially, yeah, I would.
Less than six times?
In my experience, yeah, maybe more than that, just because she was living with him. So I would see them interact when he was home at that point.
Okay. Now you described, and you recall getting interviewed by Officer Wright from the FBI. Do you recall that?
I don't recall the name, but I do recall being interviewed by a couple of agents.
And you talked a little bit about the close relationship that Tylee had with JJ. Mm-hmm. And in that interview, you described that it was, and you said it again today, that it was a very maternal relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that the two of them were very close. And you were aware of JJ's special needs, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And would it be fair to say that JJ relied on Tylee for a lot of his basic needs?
I would say he wasn't relying on her, but she was there for him. I don't think JJ really was like, this is who I rely on. He was going for anybody who was going to provide for him. But Tylee would always be the one to show up.
Okay. And she was a strong support system in his life.
Yes.
And should she be gone, he would notice that. I mean, he depended on the regularity of seeing Tylee as part of his support
system. Your Honor, I think I would object. We're calling for speculation on the part of JJ at this point.
Sustained.
Needless to say, as part of his support system, what you observed, he relied on her as part of the support system in his life. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Okay, Judge, I have nothing else. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And Your Honor, I have no redirect, and this witness is excused from her subpoena.
All right. Is she under any subpoena from the defense?
She is not, Judge. She's excused.
Okay. Thank you for appearing and providing testimony today. You can be excused.
Thank you.
You're welcome. State can call its next witness.
Judge, at this time, the state calls Dave Sensorbo.
I swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth.
All right. Now that the witness has been sworn, let me just inquire. Have you been observing any of the trial testimony that's taken place in this case?
No, I have not.
Have you talked to anyone else about any testimony they've given?
No, I have not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wixom. If you'd like to inquire, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sir, will you please state your full name and spell it for the record?
My name is David Sensorbo, spelled Sincerbeaux.
And are you currently working?
I am retired from the Idaho State Police.
Okay. And when did you retire?
February of last year.
What did you do for the Idaho State Police?
I was a forensic chemist, primarily did controlled substances, but also did fire debris cases.
Okay. How long did you do that work?
For 26 years.
Prior to doing that for the state police, where did you work, if anywhere?
I worked as an environmental chemist down in California for 10 years with two different organizations.
Okay. And how many years did you spend working for those two organizations?
About 10 years.
What did you do for them?
With the exception of what I was analyzing for, I was basically analyzing for gasoline and some pesticides.
And can you, let's go back to your work for the Idaho State Police. What types of cases did you become involved with where you would analyze accelerants?
Suspected arson cases is the simplest thing.
Could you just describe a typical case that would come in for that kind of analysis and what you would do to analyze?
Typically, the evidence would come in a friction lid can, basically a paint can. It could come in a couple different ways. Occasionally we would, but primarily it would be in these cans. They would come in, they would contain, lack of a better word, fire debris, basically burnt stuff. Sometimes soil, you know, sometimes building materials, just kind of a variety, sometimes clothing. And then we would do our analysis on it and determine whether or not it contained a ignitable liquid.
What would the analysis process be in that situation?
What we would do is once we received the can, basically the analyst, we would look at it, check to make sure it was in a sealed condition. We would open it up, make a quick observation of what was actually in the inside. We would check to see if there was any significant odor of a ignitable liquid, basically gasoline, paint thinner, something like that. We would then put into the can a charcoal strip and basically suspend that up above the material, reseal the can, make sure that it's all sealed tight. We would put it in the oven for about 4 hours at roughly 70 degrees centigrade, heat it up for that 4 hours. Once it was done, we'd take it out, let it cool down to room temperature. We would then reopen that can, take out the charcoal strip, put it in a little vial, add some solvent to it, and then we would run that solvent on an instrument called the GCMS. And the GCMS would tell us primarily whether or not there was a ignitable liquid in it, ignitable liquid. And then from there, we would compare that to a known standard, and that's how we would make our identification.
Could you briefly explain to the jury how the GCMS works?
Sure. The GCMS is a two-part instrument. The first part's a GC. It's called a gas chromatograph. And what it is a temperature-controlled oven that has a special column on the inside of it. The solvent that contains our unknown will basically be volatilized. The gas has been sent through that column, and that column will separate out organic molecules primarily by molecular weight, i.e. the small lightweight ones go through faster, the heavier ones take more time. Once the separation has been done, it goes to the mass spectrometer, which is the MS. And that will basically, as the compounds come out, it bombards it with a set of electrons. The electrons will then blow that compound apart. It collects then all of the fragments. The fragments are indicative of what the compound was. And what we do, if we were actually to identify a specific compound, is we take the retention time, how long it took to come out of the column, and what its fragmentation pattern looked like. For fire debris, we don't do that very often. We tend to look at the overall pattern, and then we look at classes of compounds that are petroleum-based. So basically, and that's what our ignitable liquids can be.
Thank you. And I believe I overlooked asking, but explain to the jury your educational background.
Sure. I have a bachelor's of science degree in chemistry. I've been an analytical chemist since 1985.
If you reflect back over the years of your work for either the state police or your prior employers, approximately how many cases do you think you've been involved with where you've had to try to identify from fire debris what the accelerant was?
Cases probably between 50 and 100, probably closer to the 50 end.
And do you recall working on a case involving Tylee Ryan?
Yes, I do.
Is that something that came in 2020 to your agency?
Yes, it did.
And what was referred to you in that case?
There was a friction lid can that came in.
Okay. And do you remember who the referring agency was?
I do not off the top of my head.
You recall if it was law enforcement?
Yes, it was.
Do you recall what you were being asked to evaluate from the referring agency?
They had a request for looking for the presence of an ignitable liquid.
Okay. What did they specifically send you that they asked you to evaluate?
What was on the inside of the can?
Yes, sir.
The inside of the can contained some decomposing flesh and some basically debris. There's some other like dirt and sticks and stuff like that.
Okay. And what in fact did you do with the material they sent you?
Like I talked about, I identified kind of what it looked like. I then put it in a charcoal strip, put it in the oven for 4 hours, and then took out the strip, analyzed it with my GCMS, and came up with a conclusion.
Did you determine what things were inside of the can specifically?
Yes, I did.
What was that?
It contained gasoline, and it also contained what appeared to be some compounds that are indicative of decomposing flesh.
So the material inside of the can had decomposing flesh?
Yes, it did.
And you determined through your analysis that it also had gasoline?
That is correct.
Do you recall if there was anything else in the container that you received in addition to the flesh?
There was some debris and some soil.
So when you did your analysis, was it possible or is it possible to determine where the gas vapor was coming from the debris versus the flesh?
There's not. It's just there was gasoline in that can.
And just the last couple of questions. When you perform this analysis and you put the charcoal strip inside the can, and then you said you heat it, correct?
That is correct.
Is there any way to determine what items, from items that are inside the can, to determine where the vapor is generating from?
No, it's just somewhere in there, it had gasoline vapors.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor, I have no more questions.
All right. Cross-examination.
No questions.
All right. Well, Mr. Cincero, that will conclude your testimony this morning then. Thank you for appearing.
Yeah. Do I apologize? I don't know if I heard the court determine if he should be released or not.
I actually did not make that determination. Is he going to be recalled?
He will be released from the state, yes.
Okay.
No subpoena, Judge.
Okay. Should have mentioned that on your way out, though, Mr. Cincero. Thank you for appearing. If you are released from any subpoena in this case, I'm free to leave. All right. The state would call its next witness.
The state would call Detective Chuck Insidus.
Very well.
Stipulated.
Okay.
Swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God. Thank you.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.